Welcome back to the Mawadising Show, the visiting place. I'm Shirley Nordrum.
And I'm Sharon Nordrum.
This is a show about visiting folks, about their art, their music.
The art of living. So if you know somebody with something cool that they do and you would like to have them interviewed for our show, please give me a call at 218-308-4818.
Today we're visiting with Gerald White, Indian Education Director for the Deer River School District. We're going around to schools that are serving Native students. And so what's good? What's going on? What's happening?
So anyway, our school here, we got lots of things. I think we're going to start a new program for 7th and 8th graders for beating.
Oh, yeah?
I think it's very, like, when kids get into something really intense like beating or really focused like beating, it's really helpful for them in their academics. Mm-hmm. So we really thought about how are we going to engage these Native kids in this school district here. Because historically, teachers didn't utilize our program as much as they should have. You know, and they still don't today. You know, one thing about public schools is that the way they teach is the way they teach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they've been taught.
Yep.
Nobody's told them any different. You know, nobody's come up to them and said, why don't you try some of our ways of teaching?
Right.
Why don't you look at this from a different perspective, through a different lens? You know, when you look at public education, it's all about testing, it's all about behavior, it's all about a lot of different things like that. And a lot of our kids come from an environment that a lot of teachers don't understand. And they don't, they've never experienced it. They're all like mostly white middle class people, majority of in general, you know. Yeah. It's like how do you communicate to people like that don't understand cultural diversity? The American system is brought up to the salad, the stew, you know, the melting pot theory. But I don't agree with that. We all have our unique ways of doing things, and we need to hang on to those, especially us Native people.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You know, we have so many kids in this school from, well, they're all, half of them are European descent, half are Native.
Okay, you're half and half.
Half and half. 1,000 kids here, give or take a few here and there. And most of the white kids don't know anything about their culture, you know, their original culture, where they came from, because they're all immigrants.
Right.
They're all immigrants, you know, and we have a couple of Hispanic kids in here. They're not really immigrants. You know, they've been on this continent forever.
Exactly.
I mean, it's like,
yeah.
What are you thinking?
Yeah.
So I don't consider the kids from Central or South America immigrants at all.
No.
You know, I consider them part of our family, you know, the family of North and South America, but everybody else is immigrants, and people don't realize that. They think the United States is something that we all should be alike. We all need to speak a common language. We all need to be religious in church.
Yeah.
If we don't go to church, for a lot of people, it's like we're sinners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to me, it's a very, very misunderstood subject in education on how educators view teaching. If you don't do it our way, you're going to fail. You're a failure. I'm going to give you an F. I'm going to give you an F because you didn't take my test and pass that test because it's American history. American history, talking about U.S. government, state government, county government. How did they get there? You know, they were settlers and pioneers and so forth. But, you know, to me, it's like, well, you know, you need to back up there and retell that story because they're not settlers or pioneers. They're land thieves and squatters. So you displaced a lot of people here, you know. I tell kids that there was 20 million plus people on this continent before European settlement. And they're so stunned by that. Because there's only, 2 or 3 million of us now?
Yeah.
I said by the 1900s, there was 200,000, 300,000.
Right.
And, you know, there's our own kids are stunned by that stuff that we teach in our school here, Ojibwe history and culture. Because we talk about going all the way back to the paleo and forward. So we don't really know much about anything that far back, really.
Yeah.
You know, we can look at spear points and pottery sherds and things like that, but, you know, we can radiocarbon fire pits and that kind of thing, but that's all we know.
Exactly.
You know, we don't, but our oral history tells us a story about what happened.
Right.
You know, and we put that in our culture class, history class. And everything we talk about in there is like, kind of like startling information. Because nobody tells the kids that. Our kids, Native kids. And white kids, too. They take the class as well. And all the white kids are welcome to participate in everything we do. We don't select who we're going to teach. You know, we let them select what they want to take.
Yeah, what they want to learn.
Yeah.
Are there a lot of non-Native kids that take your Ojibwe history?
Usually about half and half.
Yeah?
Well, that's cool.
That's
yeah,
good.
Yeah. And they're, I mean, I say the same thing that I'm saying to you. Mm-hmm. And they, being the young people they are, they're not too startled by anything like that. But they are very curious. What am I not learning in this school? One girl wrote me a note 2 years ago. She said, "Dear Gerald, I just wanted to express," finally she said, "I didn't realize how beautiful your culture was." And she said, "Thank you very much." I mean, that's, you know, something... Mm-hmm. That's better than a paycheck.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So we cover a lot of material here in the school, and that's just Ojibwe history and culture class. In our language class, we kind of struggle with that because it's hard to find consistency and instruction, I guess you could call it. It's hard to find Ojibwe language teachers.
Yeah.
But our philosophy here is we're trying to figure out a method to teach kids, and we're trying to do it up at the King through fifth grade. Personally, I do not want the kid just to learn how to say raccoon and porcupine and skunk. You know, we need to talk about how language develops, like in a one-year-old baby. What do you say to a one-year-old baby? Come here. Are you hungry? Do you want to eat? Catch the ball, throw the ball, you know, those kind of phrases, mm-hmm. you know, basic phrases.
Basic phrases, yeah.
Yeah, and then, but you don't explain what that is in English, right?
Right.
If you were raising your child as a little Ojiblet, that little Ojiblet would be sitting on a floor or on a mat looking at you, and you'd be mom or dad talking to that baby in Ojibwe, right?
Right.
You wouldn't explain it in English.
No.
You wouldn't explain anything. You would just say, you'd throw the ball, and you'd say, catch the ball. And then you'd have that baby throw it back, right. And you'd tell that baby what that is. Are you hungry? Do you want to eat? Do you like it? You know, that kind of stuff.
Agree with you. I think the explanation of what the word is in English is taking away from the language.
Right, right, right. It's diminishing our language.
Yeah, the dictionary is like the dictionary. You know, they give you the word and then what it means in English, and it doesn't even mean that in English.
Right.
Each little sound has it. You know, I think the dictionary was like the downfall of the learning of, true learning of Ojibwe language. And I don't think they thought that that was going to happen, but...
It's a good resource, but, you know, the thing that I think about the most is when the old folks talk to people that use the... a dictionary to learn the language, they get kind of confused sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, I'm not a fluent speaker, not even close to being a fluent speaker, but, you know, I can usually figure out what people are saying, mm-hmm. and I usually can't communicate back, you know,
right.
So, I mean, I'm not trying to be critical of anything, I'm just explaining what my theory is on that, you
right.
know, so.
Yeah. It's mine too, and I'm where you're at. I understand far more that I could ever say back to you, you know.
Yeah, but maybe by the time I'm 70, I'll be able to speak, you know, or, I don't know, maybe sooner. I don't know. It depends on me, I guess.
It does. It depends on us right. as learners of that. And I think that one of the things I just read or just watched was a TED Talk about language. And he said that the biggest inhibition to learning, and he was talking about Chinese, was the fact that people try to put it together in their head before they speak it. And he said, you know, when a baby starts speaking, it doesn't make sense. It's right. gibberish, you know, or in this case, Ojibberish.
Yeah.
So just keep speaking it and don't worry about laughing or teasing or what's going to happen. You're going to gain that fluency just by doing it.
Yeah, I was talking to my little grandson here last week, and he was standing in front of me. He was holding onto my knees, and he likes to pound the drum. And he had his drumstick in his hand, and I said... I try to say Ojibwe words to him.
Mm-hmm.
So we were sitting there. I was sitting on a couch, and he was standing in front of me looking at me. And I say, and I should say in Ojibwe, but I didn't. I was just saying, say grandpa. And I kept repeating that. And he goes, pampa, pampa. And then he kind of got bored and took off. But I was thinking about that, and I say, you know, we got to start using mm-hmm. Ojibwe for that little guy. Because his brain is...
Sponge, yeah, right now is the
right
time.
Plastic, you know, it's malleable. You can learn another language. So that's our philosophy here at the school in our language program. And we got a young man named Andrew Jackson who comes from a very traditional family up in Inger there. And he has the same philosophy.
Good.
So we're going to start developing our language program at the river. What the heck is
we're
that?
We're starting up the lawnmower.
So we want to, you know, our goal is to have the best Indian education program in the state, whatever that means. I don't know what that means because yeah. I don't know what other people do, but we just keep plugging away at it. So language is key to everything we do here.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully in the next few years, we're going to put... We do a little bit of Ojibwe language in our woodworking. You know, we talk about what the wood is, how the wood is, how the cedar tree is important to the Ojibwe's. We go out in the woods and we cut it, and I show them how to find straight cedar. Because sometimes cedar is bent. You can look at the bark.
Yep.
So if you cut down a cedar tree and you split it, it'll be like that. So you gotta select it carefully. And then I talk about what we do when we cut the cedar tree down, you know, if it's living. We usually take dry cedar from, of course, our friend Yamek, always, beaver always floods out somewhere, so you can always find dry cedar anywhere on the res. So we go out in the woods and we take our class out there on a bus. I usually catch a bunch of walleyes in the fall and we have a fish fry out there. Teach them how to build a fire. You know, kids don't know how to build a fire.
They don't.
So we build a fire and, you know, I go out and show them how to cut the trees down. We split them in the woods with an axe and wedges. We split it down into boards and then, you know, the kids haul everything out of the woods. You know, around lunchtime, Lavender usually starts frying up the fish and the kids help doing that as well. We have fish, berries, wild rice, and sometimes she makes bannock or something like that out there. And so it's a really awesome time. The last two sessions we had out in the woods this fall and last fall is pretty wet and cold.
Yeah.
And I have kids in mind, though.
No.
I mean, they're standing there lining up for their fish and food, and everybody's hungry and really enjoy it. So we talk about netting, we talk about how important the berries are for the Ojibwe's, how important the wild rice is, and we cover that in Ojibwe history and culture too. So they get it from woodworking and they get it from our history class. So the woodworking portion, you know, we make flutes out of that wood, we make paddles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I give them a demonstration usually on how to make a paddle, and I kind of tell a story about the cedar tree or any kind of story about, you know, for example, how did I learn how to make paddles? It's a lot of instinct and a lot of observation, I guess, for me, because my great-grandfather was a canoe maker and a carver. Yeah. And on both sides of my family, they're good carvers, so everything I touch, you know, it seems like I can make nice things. And I want to teach the kids that. So we make flutes and paddles. We go out spearing with our decoys we make. We make fish decoys.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, and it's the kids are... I mean, when you see a big northern come up to your decoy you made in class, you're going to remember that forever.
Yeah, you were.
You know, and you're going to appreciate your skill, and you're going to appreciate the lakes and the water and everything else. And, man, that's an irritating noise.
That sounds like the dentist drill.
But yeah, we have the woodworking class and the language classes, and we also have we're also looking at art, Ojibwe art.
Yeah.
And Lavender's a really talented artist with sewing and beading and and she also works with the girls, because as a male, you know, there's certain things I will not talk to about talk to a girl about. Not that I don't want to, but it's because I don't know.
Yeah.
As a Ojibwe man, you know, there's things that we don't cross that line.
Right.
You know, and it's up to a woman to teach those girls how to be with their skirts. And, I mean, I don't know anything about it. You know, I know they look pretty. You know, that's about it. So there's a lot of things that we do here with art. And we make, it's kind of like therapy.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot of troubled kids on our res.
Yep.
They're all over.
Yeah, they're all over.
Troubled children all over the place.
We've had non-Native girls make skirts in here, and, you know, some people might be off about non-Native kids participating in Ojibwe activities, but I don't mind at all.
No.
I mean, it's like, okay, if you want to learn, you know, you learn it from us then.
Yeah, right.
You know, rather than...
I don't know why anybody would be upset about that, because all it does is take down that racial barrier.
Well, there's rulemakers, you know, there's rulemakers. You know, we got rulemakers at the powwow, we got rulemakers at ceremonies, we got rulemakers. Everything that we do, we have rulemakers that think they're experts on whatever. And I don't agree with that. It's like Albert Churchill. You know him? Did you know him?
He was an
awesome man from, I think he was from over by McGregor over there somewhere, East Lake or somewhere. He was a Mille Lacs person. He told me one time, and this has always been my philosophy too, Albert Churchill, he told me, what they do over there is their business. And he says, what you do here is your business.
Yeah.
You know, meaning that what you do is how, you know, you do it the best way you can.
Right,
that's what I took it to be. And he said, never mind those people over there. They're doing what they do.
Right.
So, I mean, that was the best advice I've ever got, you know, and very kind man. You know, I really owe a lot to Mille Lacs elders for my sobriety in my life.
Yeah.
You know, I've been sober for 34 years or so.
Wow.
Somewhere around that. You know, I never kept track of it after I quit.
Yeah, that's where I'm at with that, you know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's a different lifestyle.
Yeah, I know, because I quit when I found out I was going to have Andreas. He just turned 25, so 26 years.
Yeah, my oldest son is 30, and I quit about 4 years before he was born.
Yeah, so I'm guessing
I was 5 years old when I quit.
So still pushing that 39.
No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, so our philosophy here about our art and everything else is inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mom told me that our spirituality, our religion, our Madewin, whatever you want to call it. My mom told me that what it means is you treat your fellow human with respect.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
She didn't say you treat your fellow native, your fellow anything else. She just said your fellow human.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes the Asian people, the black people, the white people, you know, everybody. And you treat everybody like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a good path to follow, I think.
Yeah, that is the good path.
It is.
So that's what I tell our kids too in the school. It's very hard to do.
It's very hard.
You know, you
struggle every day.
Well, you go out into the street out there, and cops might be pestering you because you're native. I mean, that's happened to me numerous times. Yeah, I know there's good cops out there, but I also know there's a lot of bad cops out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell the kids that too. You know, it's just be cautious.
Yeah.
About that. So in our class, we talk about all these things, and art is so, like I was saying, it's very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some kids here that have had very difficult struggles in their life, and we've had kids here that don't come to school, and it still happens. You know, we're not miracle workers by any means, but it helps them, and it helps them be creative. It helps them think about their identity, and it helps them realize that they are Anishinaabe people.
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff that we do helps them a lot.
It does.
And I think that's why we have 450-plus kids here in the school now, from 262 or something, 265, somewhere around that neighborhood.
Where are you pulling your kids from, do you know?
They're all from Inger and Balclav area, and some from Bina. And
are there kids that are because of the open enrollment, maybe coming further to Deer River rather than...
There's some kids that come from Bina.
Yeah.
You know, most of the kids that we have are from Inger and Balclav.
Okay.
And that's a lot of kids for those two little villages.
That's what I was trying to wrap my head around. Yeah. Like, you know, S Lake is, what, 24 houses?
They're busy up there.
In the Grand Rapids district, so they come over, some of them come over here, but some staying at school over there, too. So, but I'm really happy that these kids come here.
Yeah.
You know, we welcome every kid. You know, we got kids from Red Lake here. We got... We've had a couple Boys Fort kids. We've had a couple Fond du Lacers. You know, every kid that we meet here in the school, we try to tie some kind of connection together with them. For example, I know your grandpa, I know your auntie, I know your family or whatever. And the kids sense that we're family.
Right.
So we have a family atmosphere. Lavender cooks with this thing all the time, and we're out eating in here. You know, the kids the kids have wild rice a lot, you know, and we had Lavender made wild rice and meats last week, and this thing was like, there's that much in there, and it was gone within minutes.
Yeah.
And then there's a woman named Melanie Erickson that comes in here every Thursday. She brings a couple bags of oranges and apples and pastries, and the kids, you know, they appreciate that, and she does it every week.
Yeah,
that's nice.
That is so touching, you know, it's like... What a kind woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just
need more like that.
That's what I think too, is if everybody was that nice, you know.
Boy, can you imagine what the world would be like?
Yeah, it's amazing, huh? Yeah, so
it's supposed to be like
And we have this art class. We have a one formal art class now, and it, Lavender has made her creativity is expressed in that class. You know, some of the girls have made skirts in there. Some of the boys have made wall hangings. They actually sewed them together.
Yeah,
used a needle and thread. And we had a young man here named George. He made a dance outfit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and some of the girls have made jingle dresses and ribbon skirts. And, you know, so that art class, we got a young man that comes in here and beads every single day. Every morning, he comes over and does beadwork.
That must be how he prepares for his day if it's that routine that
it's a routine
that gets
for him
set.
You know, he's intent on dancing this summer.
Is he?
Oh, yeah, for sure. He's got everything ready to go. And then next year, we're going to have a class specifically for the middle schoolers, and they got a high metabolism, those kids. So we gotta really focus on, so what we're gonna do is beading.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've noticed that kids that get into beading, they're like hyper or something, you know, they're really gonna, they won't leave it alone sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the girls have made earrings. Mm-hmm. One of the first projects they did this fall was they probably made 30 or 40 pair of earrings, and they sold them for having a hand drum exhibition.
Our roundy.
Yeah, so the girls did fundraisers like that, and it was like, wow. You know, they were making their own money. They got like $7,000 in their account here at the school.
Nice.
For fundraisers. You know, it's not only...
Can I take a loan?
It's not only the girls, but the community, too. When the kids need something, you know, we try to give them at least one trip a year somewhere. This year, Lavender took them to the Minneapolis Art Institute.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and they gave us free tickets, actually.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
really nice.
Yeah, and then we went to the Science Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And we were sending kids. I think today, actually, a bunch of kids went down to the Wax Museum.
Oh, yeah.
And so we try to do a lot of mix our culture with some of the other things, too.
Right.
You know, not only just focus on Native culture, but, you know, we want them to see other culture.
Right. I think that trip to the art museum, sorry I cut you off, but
no, that's right.
You know, that's so cool because you're focusing on art and then you get to see, you know,
other art
just brings it together, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing to see the kids' faces when they do something.
Yeah.
They come in there and say, look, Gerald, and you go, whoa, that's awesome. So, and then our art class, you know, beading, and we have a Ojibwe art class, middle school class, and then we also have drum and dance. So we have a class, I think it's third hour, where the kids get together and dance. And seventh hour, we have drum. So we have, during the day, we have singing in the school, and end of the day, we have dancing in the school. So next year, we're going to do flute recitals with our band group.
That'll be fun.
So our superintendent suggested that to me. He said, wouldn't that be great if you had a bunch of kids play the flute during our spring concert or our winter concert, whatever they call that? So I guess I got to go to one of those and see what they're about. I've never been to one, ever. I mean, I don't know, we got so much going on. Yeah, this year we've had our first drum for a flag song at one of our basketball games.
Oh, yeah,
actually, awesome. It a couple times. And we've never had a drum here in the school.
Really?
Well, we've had drums in the school, but we haven't had a drum representing the school.
Right, yeah.
We haven't had the singers, because you know how kids are so shy. And,
mm-hmm. You
know, I got to give Mark Kingbird some kudos for getting those boys motivated to sing. You know, now we got Andrew Jackson here,
mm-hmm.
And Sherwin has been pounding the drum up at the King School with the kids for years, but we got... When they get into high school, it's kind of hard to get them to sing, so we kind of follow those boys from the King School up to here.
Oh, okay.
And now they're singing every day, so a few years, they're going to be pretty good singers.
Nice.
Yeah, and they made a new drum here.
Did they?
Oh, man, it's beautiful. They painted an art class on Ojibwe floral designs.
Oh, pretty.
Oh, my God, it's going to be beautiful when it's done. It's probably sitting somewhere drying up now because I think they just stretched the hides yesterday. We got a lot of things going on here that are so positive for the kids, and I wish we had a better way to disperse the information to the communities, because a lot of the community members don't really know what we're doing here.
That's kind of what we're doing. We're like, what's going on in Indian Ed and what's going on with our kids? And so all the good things that you're doing, how is that transferring into academic success?
Well, if I believe what I'm being told, Deerver is one of the schools that is making significant progress on the achievement gap. Mm-hmm. And a couple of years ago, we had a Native girl max the MCA in math.
Really?
Which is really hard. And then some of the kids up at King School have done really well, and kids up here have done really well. I don't know what exact numbers are this year, but I hear it's really good. Deerver has made like 38 percentile gain in some areas, you know, and the state average is about 1%.
Right.
I think the overall effort at the school to be inclusive have made an impact on how kids do in their academics. Because, you know, at the King School, we have a program called Positive Behavior Interventions.
Mm-hmm.
PBIS, and it's rather than punishing, it's more like a positive reinforcement of behavior, and that carries on to the high school here. Mm-hmm. You know, we get those kids from over there, and we still have a lot of people that are in the old punishment mode. You know,
right.
String them up, it'll teach them a lesson type thing. But we try to be as positive as possible with the kids. And you know how that minorities get kicked out of school more than...
Yep.
I mean, here, it's not that way. 4 years ago, I think there was like 1,600 behavior referrals in the school. And probably 900 to 1,000, maybe a little bit more, were Native kids. A couple of years ago, it was like 900 and some. So that number went down.
Mm-hmm. That's really significantly.
Oh, huge. And less than a third were Native kids.
That's even better.
I mean, if you're a numbers person, a numbers puncher,
yeah,
and that's what people need to look at when they're looking at school success.
They do.
Numbers.
The numbers.
Yep.
The numbers and things like that, it's really telling. You just can't go into a school and say, this is a nice school. You got to look at what's happening.
Right.
You know, the discipline, that kind of thing. But we do have problems with attendance in some of the schools.
I was just going to ask you about attendance, because there's some criteria. It's like... academic success and behavior and attendance.
Well,
and then how does that
get to address that too? Yeah. You know, the thing about attendance is that if kids are engaged in school, they're engaged because they're either interested in something or there's somebody there that they want to see.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we take that as us, of course, for the Native kids. But also, we're looking at what interests the kids. So that's why we develop all these programs.
Mm-hmm.
And, I forgot to mention videos.
Oh, are you doing video?
We're going to... You know the Foxfire series?
Uh-huh.
Where this guy in Appalachia got all these kids to write books.
Right.
Uh-huh. Interview elders. So what we're doing here is, and we already started, was we got GoPros, we got HD cameras, and the kids are going to videotape all our cultural activities.
Nice.
Cool.
Yeah, so we've had a couple kids that were truant come almost every... probably almost every single day for the last 2 months.
Because they wanted that.
Because they want to use the GoPros and they want to use the HD cameras and they want to do all this videotaping. And as soon as that gets, it's kind of like a pilot project this spring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we haven't really focused a lot of attention on it, but we've kind of like introduced it. So the kids are really asking me about it. I said, well, you can use the GoPros if you want.
Mm-hmm.
So I let them check them out. And one kid has a YouTube site.
Does he?
So probably more than that one kid now, but yeah, they come and show me their little videos they make, and it's like, whoa, these are cool. That kind of thing engages kids in the school.
It does.
You know, and they do better in their academics, too, when they get something interesting. So, you know, one thing that I wanted to mention, too, is that other school districts that are struggling with, their identity and what they're doing in that district, you know, they can always come over here, talk to us about what we do here. I went to the state Indian education meeting, for Indian homeschool liaisons. And, you know, we talk about the same thing every year.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about the achievement gap, we talk about special education, you know, but we don't talk about how do we change that.
Don't talk about innovation.
Yeah, innovation.
Innovation and education.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, I want to plug also Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers.
Yeah.
I've been working on a committee since last year about increasing those numbers. Because,
mm-hmm.
you know, kids, when they see me at Walmart or something, you know, kids are like, Mom, there's my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really important to them.
It's very important.
When they see me dancing at a powwow, you know, and they come up to me and they go, "I really like your dancing." And I go, "Yeah, I like, where's your dance outfit? You know, and come and dance." You know, it's like being part of the community.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's, teachers need to be part of the community.
Right.
I mean, then the kids are going to see that positive role in the community, and they're going to want to be like that, because yeah, that's human nature to want to, when you see what you like, you want to emulate that.
Right.
So, I've, you know, the young folks that I know going to school, I've just been encouraging, you know, be a teacher.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's like, I want to be a lawyer. We need lawyers.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with that. But, and I know there's probably more money in that.
Oh,
but,
yeah, for sure.
But
but there's, you know, a longer there's education and higher student loans.
Yeah.
But there's more things in life than money, and community is one of them, and you can build that community by being, you know.
Well, one thing about community here is that, you know, we never see the teachers at our events.
Nope. No.
You know, the non-native teachers. You know, that's what I think is that, you know, we take care of ours and they take care of theirs. Yeah. Well, what we're trying to do is like, okay, if you want to call us part of your community, this is a community school, and we got a community school grant.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, we got to look deeper at some of these things. You know, it's not just it's just not having a fundraiser for somebody that's part of their not native community. If their house burns down, and then one of our families, their house burns down, and you know, there's a disparity there.
Yes, there is.
And that's the same thing with educating kids with the curriculum they use. It's the same thing.
Right.
You know, they got a curriculum that's based on public education policy and what they have available. And when they're educating our kids with that curriculum, they're forgetting about a whole different culture here.
Yeah.
A whole different history, a whole different viewpoint. They don't say, well, we need to look at a little further, deeper into Native people's history and incorporate a lot of that into here, because we're 50% of our students are Native.
Right.
That doesn't happen. You know, how do we address that? You know, I've had discussions with administration about that, and it's not as easy as it sounds.
It should be just easy.
Well, it should be, but you know, it's the way they do things.
Yeah, I think that one thing I'm wondering about lately is like what you're describing is there's this concept of equality. And there's this concept of equity, and they're very different things. So the education system is providing this same education for everyone, so everyone's equal.
But it's not.
But it's not equitable, because you need to know you're on Native land. This is home, always has been, always will be. We have a history, we have ways of teaching, and we have gifts. And when you bring that in to the bigger mix of education, then you have equity. Kind of what I've been thinking about lately.
Yeah, you know, when you look at social studies or history, one of our classes had a section called Indian Wars. Okay, some of our kids were very upset about that, what they were told in that class. I mean, like the Comanches were like wiping out settlers and pioneers, you know, because they were trying to steal their land.
Mm-hmm.
They were coming in, killing off the game, killing off their livelihood for their families,
mm-hmm,
and doing all these other things, all these atrocities to the Comanches.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't cover that, though.
No.
They didn't say why the Comanches, or any other tribe for that matter, was
exactly
fighting. They don't say that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't say that these people were coming into Indian country, Native people's lands, and trying to squat there without permission. So what these people with settlers and pioneers would do is, government, the natives are attacking us for no reason. So that's the story that we tell,
yep,
here in our public school. They don't say that all these squatters were slaughtering the buffalo and the antelope,
yeah,
and the elk and all the other creatures. And they don't say that all these different nations were defending their lands. They don't say that.
No.
What they say is that these natives were attacking settlers and pioneers. They call it the Indian Wars.
Yep.
So when the kids get upset in that class and they come in here and they say, well, why are they saying that? And I tell them why, and they say, oh, okay. You know, they feel better,
mm-hmm,
because I tell them, well, this is how it was. Pushing westward at the with government permission, because if the government could have stopped them.
Yeah, they could have.
They could have stopped them.
They were opening up land, though. They were
right,
sending people out
right,
to, you know, 6 mile by 6 mile.
Right. So So when the kids get upset about that, you know, the teachers should talk about that gray area.
Yeah, they should.
You know, and say
they may not know it.
They don't know it because they think that...
They think what's in the book is...
Yeah, the land was not being used.
We were at a workshop for artists and producers.
Oh, yeah, you guys seen your post.
And there was a man there, and he said he'd been, I don't know, living up in Alaska near some native village for 30 years, and the people up there weren't utilizing the salmon like they should, and he wanted to put a cannery or whatever there.
A processing plant.
I'm like, how long have the indigenous people been there? You've been there 30 years and you think you know what's best
right.
for them.
Yeah. Obviously, they don't want one. Otherwise, they would put one up there.
You know? I'm pretty sure if the... You know,
they weren't wiping out the salmon.
Yeah, yeah, they weren't exploiting it to the... You know, he could see
to
a
the
salmon.
To the full extent.
Yep.
To sell and make money.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's...
They don't see a life. They see a dollar sign.
Yeah. Well, it's like on Leech Lake here. You know, I tell kids that... A lot of family groups a long time ago were scattered all over. Mm-hmm. They needed 10,000 acres, let's say, for survival. Because, you know, there's only a certain amount of, there's a carrying capacity there of game, of fish. So they said, well, we can live in this area, and then we move to this area for our sugar bush, and then this other area. So they, I don't know, maybe they used 30,000 acres for each family group.
Yeah.
And that's how much land we used. And that's how we made our living. You know,
it is. It was a nomadic economy.
I was just talking to my third graders about that, and I said, and we walk. I said, we walked from the summer camp to the winter camp, and it was...
Or paddled.
Yeah, you know, and I said, we did this. And they're like, why did you walk? Why didn't you use cars? I was like...
third graders.
we didn't have cars. We didn't have... I said, we didn't have horses. We walked, and I said, and then if they had to bring news down from someplace, if there were runners. Oh, my Lord, I can't even imagine running home, and I just lived down the road.
But, well, that's the other point, too, is how athletic were we?
Yeah, very.
You know, in 1915 or 1916, somewhere around there, the Hominy Indians beat the world champion New York Giants in football. I mean, it's like Jim Thorpe, greatest athlete in the world, greatest athlete ever, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And we took pride in our ability to, in our abilities,
right,
as warriors, as men, you know, and I don't know what the women did. Just kidding. Cooked. No, I'll probably get myself in trouble here. I better stop. But yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, the women took care of everything.
Yeah.
You know, the women were ricers.
Mm-hmm.
They took care of the Manoman. You know, they did everything. And our job was different. The economy of our tribal nations changed. You know, when we look at education, they took our families off our homelands and put them in boarding schools.
Yeah.
You know, my grandma was taken when she was 7, I think, or I don't know, until she was like 12, went to boarding school.
Right.
You know, and my grandma, I mean, I loved her so much, and, you know, I just think about her all the time. You know, and my grandpa and all the old folks, how did they endure that?
I know. I think about that too. You know, like, I remember one of the last things I remember about my grandma. I was 7. She passed away when I was 7. And she come to visit us. I think she knew she was going to journey on.
Uh-huh.
And she spent some time with us. And in the morning time, she was just a small woman. I think she was 5'2". In the morning times, she would have her hair undone, and her hair went all the way to her ankles.
Wow.
And she would comb her hair, and then she'd braid it and then put it in a bun. You couldn't tell it was that long. And I was like, Grandma, you know, how come your hair is so long? And that was the only time that I'd ever heard her speak of boarding school. Mm. And she told me that when they took her away and took her to school, they cut her hair. And that when they cut her hair, she said when she knew when she left there that she would never cut her hair again.
Mm.
So from the day she left school to that morning that she told me that, she had never cut her hair.
That's amazing.
That, you know, that tells me her pain. Mm-hmm. That every morning when she lovingly brushed her hair, I bet you she thought about what happened. So
yeah, and we carry that pain today. You
know,
I carry my grandma's pain.
Yeah.
Know? I don't know if she had pain or not, but she never told me that. Mm-hmm. But I know that it hurts to be away from your mom and dad.
Yes.
Because I was away from my mom and dad when I was a little kid because of relocation. Mm-hmm. You know, we went on relocation to Cleveland, Ohio. My dad was going to be trained as a welder, and we got on a train and went out to Cleveland, Ohio. I remember it so distinctly because first time I sat in a checkered cab. I was like amazed at the seat rose up from the floor, like you a fold-on chair. And I remember hearing the train going click, 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 you know, for all night. I don't know. It might have been all night. I don't remember. But going from a shack to a high-rise.
Yeah.
And then coming back after my dad had done moving to the Twin Cities, my dad got a job down there. And my mother tried to live down there, but me and my brother went up to live with Grandma. And I used to miss my mom so much. My dad, you know, it was like, it was probably only like 4 or 5 days out of the week, then they'd come back up north. But I can't imagine going years.
Years, and then by the time you do get together, you don't even know each other.
Yeah, painful.
It was very painful, very disruptive.
And that's, I think that's part of our issues with public school. I think a lot of Americans don't realize that we're only like first one or two generations away from being allowed to go in public schools, and they expect us to achieve in a public school that beat us down.
Mm-hmm.
If they understood that, which I doubt they will, you know, some people do, but it's the American way, you know, to blend in. And
yeah.
That's what culture is all about in America. It's like, if you're not going to be American, then you don't belong here. You know, that's what they're telling our neighbors to the south. I always say they belong here more than anybody.
Yeah, they do.
I don't know. It's such a...
We should turn it around, and if they're not going to be like us, they don't belong here.
Right, that's what they... Need a gun and a Bible. Yeah, I don't know. So, I don't know. Is there any other points that you want me to
think that's what we're here to hear. Capture the story of Deer River School and what's going well and what are the challenges that remain. And
I'm sure if you talk to some of my coworkers, it'd be a little different.
Yeah. You know, we wanted to hear from you.
Their perspective, yeah. Because we got people that support what we do here.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it wouldn't work. Yeah, so we need our principal and our administrator and some other teachers. Actually, the teacher that teaches woodworking now is a Deer River grad. Non-native, I was friends with his dad in high school.
Oh, yeah? Very cool.
Yeah, he's really cool. Very open. And our teacher is non-native, but Lavender works. They co-teach.
Yeah, nice.
So, you know, and then we lost our band teacher to Grand Rapids. They're always stealing our teachers here. they pay like $15,000 more.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, just like 14 miles away.
Well, yeah.
Talk about the disparity, you know. Our school is like 83% free or reduced lunch.
Yeah.
We're poor, but we're outperforming a lot of schools.
Well, that's good.
Yeah,
that's...
because of our leadership and... the teachers' efforts, and you know, in math, you can't be very cultural, right?
Yeah,
to a certain extent.
To an extent.
Well, you can figure out how much the ratio is of wild rice versus finished rice and stuff like that, but
and sap syrup.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like the engineering of a canoe.
Yeah,
that's math.
You know, that's tremendous math. But if you, you know, I was with Jim Jones when we made that canoe. He was measuring everything just like a million times over again because. And I was thinking, we didn't measure like that, you know? And so I really started to put myself in that place of trying to understand. Because a person could know, like a canoe maker, like your grandpa, he could know that's a ricing canoe, so I need to make that canoe for this purpose. Or if we were going to travel, I need to make this canoe for this purpose. That's math, but how do you wrap your head around that kind of math?
Well, you know, this one uncle of mine... I used to get in canoe races. So I went over to his house. I said, you know, I gotta get a canoe for this canoe race because my other one is somebody borrowed it and didn't bring it back. You know how our relatives are. borrow, but never bring back. Well, anyway, I went and borrowed his canoe.
Did you take it back?
Yeah, I took it back. But he said, you're not going to win. And I go, how do you know? He said, look at that canoe. That's the only one I got for you to use. And I said, well, yeah, it's a canoe. And he said, but it's got a square back. And I said, so? And he goes, you're not going to win, I'm telling you. He said, it's going to drag. So the water goes around the canoe, and it curls in like that.
Right.
So it kind of like sucks the canoe back, I guess you could,
in
the best terminology. On a regular canoe, it goes like this. The water goes like that.
Yep.
But... on a square back canoe, it goes like this.
Right, so you're going
to get
that
chart. Is that engineering or not?
Yeah, that is engineering.
So he was, I don't know, he went to the seventh grade maybe.
Yeah.
How do you know, that's like, and I didn't win either. I come in like third place. And we had to work hard for that third place, too. I mean, he told me right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow, I didn't know that.
Well, there's different ways of intelligence and knowing.
Right.
And that's what I think is wrong with formal education the way it is, because it only recognizes one way of knowing.
So does this war club have more force because it's curved?
Or yes, it does. Or would it
have more force because it's straight?
It's because it's curved.
Because right. It's curved,
yeah.
And how does this flute work? Waves.
Yeah.
The sound waves, every sound wave has a different wave. So when you put 5 or 6 holes on a flute, you're catching different waves. Yep. So how did they know that, you know, if you blow air through here, this tube, over and back into there, that's awesome science to me.
It is. It's tremendous science.
I mean, like paddles. You know, paddles, too. Mm-hmm. You know, when you look at the shape of a paddle, you know, either the otter tail or the beaver tail like we used,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's science there, too.
There is.
Snowshoes?
It's in everything that we did. Our whole life was about surviving and being healthy and knowing how to do that in that.
Ecology.
Yeah, ecology.
I mean, all these words that we use for science scare people away. If we just talk about the or not even use biology, we talk about a wetland.
Uh-huh.
Why did Ojibwe's catch muskrats, and where did they go, and how much did they take out of there? You know, my dad always told me, he said, don't take more than, he said, you got to leave the seed, he called it.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to catch muskrats next year, you got to leave some.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the deer, same thing with beavers, same thing with otters, same thing with everything.
Right.
If you didn't know how much critters that area could sustain and safely take out of there, you'd have no business out there. You know, that's one thing that I think we've lost today is that some of our people think that they can take as much as they want out of a lake.
They do. Or hunt as much as they want, or cut boughs by taking down the entire tree and then just, you know. There's a lot of things that are going on right now. There's a... people in our area that want those little bitty birch trees for decoration in the mountains.
Oh, yeah, they're cutting them.
And they're just cutting all those little birch trees. We're not going to have any birch trees for, you know,
I've been meaning to write a letter to DRM about some of this stuff, you know.
Actually, they said that they were going to start fining people. It was on the news, last week.
You can't find anybody on Leech Lake.
If the malls were putting up those birch trees and they didn't have permits for those trees, they were going to get fined.
Oh, they're going to get fined.
They're going to get fined, so then they're not going to buy, so then people will stop cutting.
You know, there's a way to do it, though, a sustainable way, because you look at birch trees, they grow in clumps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's 4 or 5 birch trees.
Right.
Uh-huh. Take 2.
Yep. You're going to make a healthier tree here anyway, because all the energy is going to go into those, too.
And that has to be in our newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, DRM articles, you know, things like that. It's like, okay, how about teaching people about sustainable fisheries?
Right.
Taking 5,000 walleyes out of Winnie, out of a certain area, is going to damage that fishery right there.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, it's not only yours, it's ours.
Right.
You know,
and then people have to stop and think, too. If I take that many and they take that many, what's going to happen? But everybody is just like, well, I'm taking this.
Yeah, they're only thinking about what they're doing.
Yeah, they're not thinking about what everybody else is doing.
Well, having a right to make a modest living mm-hmm. means a lot of different things.
It does.
You know, when you look at catching 5,000 walleyes. Okay, I'm working here, and I'm doing this, and I'm doing this. So if I take 5,000 walleyes, what about my neighbor?
Right.
How much walleyes are they going to take? Am I taking his portion?
Right.
You know, because we all have the rights to that.
Yeah.
It's not an individual right. But we're getting...
We're away.
Yeah. Well, it's all about education.
It is.
It is.
Education is not in our way of teaching. Everything is about teaching in our community, our native community.
And everything is related to the next thing. It's all connected.
And it doesn't stop at 12th grade.
Right.
You know, it keeps going, mm-hmm. you know.
So. For sure.
Cool.
So Miigwech for sitting down and taking time with us today, Gerald. You look drained, don't know.
It's taxing.
Well, you know, education has been my passion. I've always thought education was our pathway to having a better life.
Yeah.
You know, better life doesn't mean having a brand new car and a brand new house. It means how you look at everything.
Right.
How do you take care of your kids? How do you contribute to your community? How do you take care of our trees and our water? Because those are so important. I'm going to go water walk with them ladies this summer. I guarantee it.
All right. Good. Miigwech, Gerald.
Yep.
This program has been funded by the Legacy Arts, Culture, and Heritage Fund of Minnesota.